Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, ORZVS Recognised Specialist in Small Animal Surgery Orthopaedics, Simon Roach. Thank you, Simon. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Good afternoon. Firstly, I'd like to welcome all delegates to the webinar and thank CPD Solutions for inviting me to speak. When I first started treating fractures, and I'm sad to say that was in the last millennium, I was working in a mixed practice. The orthopaedic kit was kept in a smallish red plastic box and contained a Jacob's chuck, a hand drill, some pins, some of which were offcuts and been used possibly many times before, some rolls of wire which were kept on grubby looking wooden reels, and there was a screw rack for 3.5mm Sherman screws, and to be honest, there were more gaps in the rack than there were screws. We had a sparse assortment of bone plates that in all honesty were unfit for veterinary use and may well have been given us to us from the local hospital. At the time I knew no better and I thought we were quite a normal practice and I started to treat the fractures that were presented to me. I learnt a lot from the cases that went well and I learnt even more from the cases that went badly. With time my success rates increased and more equipment was purchased which definitely helped. These days, 20 years or so later of doing orthopaedic referral practice, my equipment needs two rooms to store. Our success rates have definitely improved massively compared to the old days. But nevertheless, bone healing still occurs in the same way and the less advanced techniques can still usefully be applied. So on with the talk. First of all, we're going to be talking about surgical management. I'm not going to cover casting and splinting. Okay. The answer to the question, can we do repair with minimal equipment, ultimately is yes. We must, however, recognize the reason why we accumulate lots of equipment in orthopedic practice, other than obviously orthopods having an unhealthy interest in shiny things and power tools, is because it increases our options when we're managing both simple and complex cases. Okay, so ultimately we have a smaller safety net to catch us. Okay, when we undertake fracture repair, we do have to be very realistic about our abilities. I would suggest before you undertake any procedure, always ask yourself the question whether you're taking on too much. So why would we want to try? Well, when I first started, things were a little bit different in the world. Clients were generally less well-informed and possibly less demanding. Dr. Google was just a glint in a computer nerd's eye. Clients were receptive to someone having a go. Fees were massively less than they are today. And typically, I guess we would have been charging £150 to £250 for a fracture repair. Specialist care wasn't as available. The specialists that there were fewer in number, and they tended to reside in the ivory towers of the universities. These days, owners have often seen similar cases on TV, and they're definitely better informed. The expectations have increased, and they're less likely to accept a malunion or a three-legged pet. There are, however, a few situations where first opinion vets may find yourselves having a go, and these are entirely reasonable. So if clients have limited funds, obviously referral may not be an option. Referral may not be feasible for other reasons, so geography, lack of transport, or even poor previous outcomes. You know, they may lean towards clients wanting to just have their local vets dealing with the situation. Maybe your boss is really tight and he won't buy equipment, but he still doesn't like things being referred. Okay. If this is the situation, then you know he or she need to consider that if you are doing orthopedics, it does bring money in, but there is a degree of outcome that's necessary. Okay. Or the other thing, you may have liked your orthopedic lectures at college and you might be gagging to get in on the action. So firstly, let's think about some old wives' tales that I'm sure some of you may have heard. Firstly, if you're told that cat fractures will heal providing they're in the same room, I can assure you that is entirely wrong. Cat fractures readily form non-unions, and they can often be less forgiving than some fractures in dogs. Secondly, animals don't do great with three legs. Okay, they can cope, but they would do better with four functional limbs. Bear in mind, three-legged pets still fracture their other legs, okay, and they can develop orthopedic disease, and having one leg missing is a massive disadvantage to them in the future. And with regard to this talk, a single IM pin is never, ever, ever enough. So if you're told these things by an old crone, and that may be male or female, I would suggest you back slowly away and seek advice elsewhere. So why do orthopods tend to accumulate masses of equipment? Well, as we've said already, it increases the options open to us. Better equipment increases accuracy in implant purchase, so that leads to more secure repairs and less implant problems. Equipment reduces time, fatigue, tissue damage, which in turn speeds healing, decreases the likelihood of sepsis and implant failure, and collectively these factors result in better outcomes. The disadvantages of having lots of equipment are that equipment can be expensive to acquire and maintain. I think it's often easy to forget that the most important piece of equipment, that is the surgeon, and becoming a competent orthopod or soft tissue surgeon for that matter, requires training and no small measure of dedication. This can be accessed in a variety of ways, including books, webinars, practical courses, but I would encourage all of you that have orthopedic aspirations to go and spend some time with an experienced surgeon to see what it entails. So, in order to move forward, we really need to determine what constitutes minimal equipment. Personally, I would say that to have any chance of a successful fracture repair, that we must have an absolute minimum of a Jacob's chuck, a drill, wire twisters, as you can see on the top right. Some sort of pin cutter, and which at pinch could be a hacksaw, and some bone holding forceps, of which there are various patterns available. With regard to implants, you need to have a selection of pins from small to large and some orthopedic wire. If you're lucky enough to have various sizes of screws, then that adds substantially to the options that we have, but seems to go slightly beyond the scope of this talk. What I would suggest as useful things to have if you don't have them already include a tube of epoxy putty, some form of basic external fixator kit, and these can be readily purchased at relatively small cost, and in certain circumstances can be really useful adjuncts to basic pin and wire application. So the most basic tool for inserting pins is a Jacob's chuck, and I'm sure everyone will probably have access to those. But there are both hand drills and power drills in common use. The problem with the Jacob's chuck and hand drills are that it's very hard to insert pins accurately and straight. So a hole drilled in bone with a hand chuck will not be parallel sided and will closely resemble a crater, due to the unavoidable wobble that occurs when twisting the chuck. If you've ever used a hand drill, the same problem occurs due to turning the crank, so they are no longer considered ideal. Power drills are a really good idea in that it gives us far better control of the implant and the drill. Many people in first opinion practice use battery powered cordless sort of DIY drills in a shroud. Whilst these can be argued to be adequate, the level of asepsis, even with a shroud on, is dubious at best, unless, of course, the whole drill has been passed through ethylene oxide sterilization. Personally, in referral practice, I wouldn't feel at all comfortable with a shrouded non-sterile drill for any surgery, so I choose only to use fully autoclaved orthopedic drills as shown on the right. This is a 3M mini driver, which is the workhorse of many referral practices, and it's a really useful piece of kit because it's got an assortment of chucks, wire drivers, and saws that work from a common handpiece. So the bottom picture in the center of the DIY drill on the surgical field We can't really use an unshrouded drill at all unless you have access to ethylene oxide. Okay. Moving on to the broken animals, there are some other things we need to ask before committing to surgery. The first thing is that, unlike many joint surgeries, fractures aren't recipe surgeries, if that makes sense. They're diverse. They often throw up curveballs during surgery, and they may be things like poor bone quality, fissures that propagate, altered landmarks caused by trauma to the surrounding soft tissues, and access that's far more difficult than it looks in the book. We need to consider the equipment and the facilities we have available. Do we have enough skill and do we have enough time to deal with the fracture along with any unexpected or complications that may arise? Are the aseptic standards of a sufficient standard to implant permanent implants? Is the owner aware of the level of expertise and facilities in comparison with referral hospitals, or would referral be a better option? If in doubt, seek help from a friendly referral centre. None of us will be disappointed to give advice whether something could be done in practice or not. And if in doubt, allow the client to make an informed decision and involve them in the process. I think perhaps the most important piece of advice is to choose the right case. Okay, don't get into the position where you've started operating when you've just finished morning surgery, you've only got dubious quality x-rays, you've got an hour until you need to be on a house visit, and you open up the skin to find a non-reconstructable fracture, such as you can see in the picture. I promise it will really ruin your day if that happens. So the ideal cases to choose are generally young, fit, and healthy, single, simple fractures sustained after minimal trauma. Often these are the dogs or cats that are dropped from the owner's arms. We want them to have reconstructable, non-articular fractures. And the reason we say non-articular is because joint fractures are really unforgiving and need stable, rigid fixation. And with the basic equipment we're talking about, that's unlikely to be achieved. And we want them to have minimal soft tissue disruption so that they heal really quickly. It's also nice to have a diligent and careful owner and a compliant animal that will tolerate cage confinement without going nuts. In order to help with case selection, we can apply a concept called fracture scoring. This gives a useful framework to apply to help us choose how risky a fracture repair may be. It is, however, highly subjective, and as you gain more experience, it almost becomes second nature. What fracture scoring emphasizes is that we need to consider mechanical factors, such as the degree of stability of the fracture and whether load sharing will be possible after surgery. The most stable fractures are incomplete or green stick fractures, or those with an intact parallel bone. And those, let me just see if I can find my pointer. And so these are listed, these factors are listed towards the right-hand side of the slide. Two-piece fractures score less, so they're over in the middle, and comminuted fractures towards the left. So the stable fractures have a far higher relative contribution to the score than the unstable fractures. We also consider biological fractures, which include the age of the patient and the overall health status, the degree of soft tissue injury, which is correlated with the likely vascular supply to the bone fragment. So don't forget that bones don't heal well without a blood supply. Clinical considerations also that could influence bone healing include the temperament of the dog and the attitude of the owner. So, using all of these factors, we pick a figure between 1 and 10 that best describes our assessment of how we anticipate the fracture will heal. So, essentially, a 14-week-old puppy with a green stick radial fracture and an intact ulna may well be a 10 out of 10 fracture score. in that it has an excellent chance of healing uneventfully, but an 8-year-old Great Dane with renal failure and a comminuted distal tibial fracture may only be a 1 or 2. If we have minimal equipment, which dictates we're going to apply very simple fixation, we need the fracture score to be a 9 or a 10 to give ourselves a decent chance of success. This means that many or even most fractures are probably best not attempted due to the risk of failure. So, moving on to good cases. There are good cases that may be treated with minimal equipment. And these include things like tibial tuberosity avulsions, okay, as shown on the left. And I would include proximal tibial physeal separations in this. And this is where the whole of the proximal tibial epiphysis has separated and rocked back under the influence of the quadriceps. Many other physeal injuries, including the quite common Salter-Harris type 1 distal femoral fracture, can also be treated very successfully. Greenstick fractures are great because there's already a substantial degree of stability. And this is also the case where there is an intact adjacent bone, such as the radius and the ulna. But simple diaphyseal fractures are also potential candidates, particularly in puppies where the thick periosteum can give both stability and a vascular supply. I would advise that you completely avoid articular fractures other than those mentioned above, especially humeral condylar fractures. And to be honest, I would avoid anything to do with humeral fracture repair, as the humerus is just a spiteful, horrible bone to work with. The approaches are often nasty. The shape of the bone is sigmoid. The bone stock's of dubious quality proximally, and the articular anatomy distally is challenging. So don't say I didn't warn you. So the humerus is a nasty, nasty bone. So when we have a fracture, we need to assess the feasibility of repair. So in other words, can the fracture configuration be adequately stabilized using the implants we have available? And we need to be able to stabilize all, and I do mean all, of the following forces which act at the fracture site. So axial loading. So what we're talking about is tension and compression. Hold on. There we go. So tension and compression. So this can be achieved by reconstruction of the bony column if you have a transverse fracture configuration, but may not occur at all with oblique or spiral fractures, as they tend to slide past each other. Bending, both in the mediolateral and craniocaudal plane. Rotation, so we're talking about pivoting around the long axis. It's often a mistake to rely on interdigitation of the fracture, because unless the bone ends are compressed and held together firmly, any separation may lead to the return of rotational instability. And shearing, so the bone ends may slide against one another. So in order to do this, we need to look at what our implants do and, importantly, don't do. If we want to play fantasy league orthopedics and we were to design the perfect implant system, we'd want to reconstruct the anatomy, resist the forces that we talked about, so axial loading, bending, rotation and shearing, and we'd want to provide support that's durable enough to allow the bones to heal for the expected period of time. How long bone healing takes depends on the factors considered during fracture scoring, so blood supply, presence of concurrent illness, age, fracture stability, etc. As a guide, in simple fractures in young, very healthy animals, fracture healing could occur in 4 to 6 weeks, but more complex fractures could take massively longer, and they could be 6 to 9 months to heal. So we don't really, we can't predict firmly how long each fracture is going to take, so we need to provide stability for a long enough period of time. We also don't want the implants to impede healing unduly. So if we start by looking at pins, which are probably the cornerstone of long bone fracture repair, where we are limited by our implant and equipment available. The design of the pins has not changed much for decades. Okay, the Steinmann pin is probably the most common orthopedic implant available in most practices. It's made of 316 LVM stainless steel and most often has a trocar point that can be drilled slowly through relatively soft bone. We've got to remember that this drilling does generate heat and can cause thermal necrosis, particularly where large pins are being placed. If you have any doubt and you think that this may be happening, then you can pre-drill a hole with a drill bit of slightly smaller diameter than the pin. And because the drill bit cuts, it will produce less thermal effects. The good thing about Steinmann pins is that they're cheap. Okay, they're often a few pounds each. And the good thing about them is they resist bending well. But the big problem is that they do not resist rotation or axial loading, so tension or compression. Because of this, a standard Steinmann pin can't be regarded as a suitable method of sole fixation. I know that there have been many fractures just fixed using a single Steinmann pin, but this isn't a reliable way to go, and these days I would regard trying to do so as being negligent potentially. There are some variants of Steinmann pins that do resist rotation better. One of these is the called a Trillium nail, which did have a vaguely triangular cross section. There may be some of these nails kicking around in practice, but I would be surprised if they're even available these days. They never really took off, and we should probably confine them to the history books. Also reported in many texts is the practice of stack pinning. So this involves driving multiple IM pins into the medullary canal of one bone. This may improve the stability to some extent, but I suspect post-operative fracture and implant loosening are probably reasonably likely. So that is something I have always avoided. So pins are available in a huge variety of diameters and lengths. Okay, the larger pins are usually around 30 centimeters long, and they may be threaded on one or both ends. Smaller, and by that I'm meaning below 2 millimeter diameter pins, are often called Kirschner wires or K wires for short, or even arthrodesis or A wires. And they're typically quite a lot shorter, so 10 to 15 centimeters would probably be average. So intramedullary pins may be used as the primary fixation implant or as a useful secondary implant. If we're placing an IM pin as the main implant, then we normally try to fill the medullary canal at the narrowest point. As the resistance of a cylindrical implant like a pin is proportional to the radius to the power of 4, a small increase in pin diameter gives a massive increase in resistance to bending, which of course can be very helpful. As you'll remember, we can't neutralize rotation with a single IM pin, so we do need to use other implants as well. The trouble is, a large intramedullary pin can make it difficult to insert other implants into the bone. Okay, so if we're planning to place other implants, such as external fixation pins, then we may need to reduce the diameter of the intramedullary pin to 30 to 50% of the medullary canal fill, or potentially get a little creative with our implant placement to get around that problem. Inserting intramedullary pins may be achieved in either a normograde or a retrograde fashion. So the difference between normograde and retrograde placement relates to the direction that the pin is initially inserted. So normograde insertion starts from the bone end and involves the pin being driven in a single direction from one end of the bone across the fracture and into the opposite segment. Retrograde insertion means that the pin's inserted from the fracture site, driven through one bone end, and then the direction of the pin is reversed to engage the other fractured segment. Both techniques do rely on the pin being driven into the metaphyseal bone distally, and this is one particular problem that we need to be aware of where we're using intramedullary pins. With the femur, I prefer to place pins normograde, as this may reduce the chance of iatrogenic sciatic neuropathy, because the sciatic nerve does pass quite close to the greater trochanter. This is more difficult than retrograde, especially in very well muscled dogs. And if you are going to use retrograde pinning in the femur, then make sure you fully extend the hip when you drive the pin from the fracture through the proximal segment to try and avoid the sciatic nerve. Once the distal end of the pin is present at the fracture site, the bone ends are toggled together and the fracture reduced, and then the pin is driven into the distal segment. We need to be careful that the joint is not penetrated distally, as that can cause a significant problem in the long term. In the tibia, the pin's inserted normal grade from the medial aspect of the tibial plateau, and in the humerus, the pin is inserted from the lateral side of the greater tubercle. As we've said, the Achilles heel of the IM pin is that it only resists bending, and it's also only an applicable implant for the femur, the tibia and the humerus due to the anatomy. It's possible to use intramedullary pins in other bones, such as the radius, but it's actually a pretty stupid thing to do so, as it inevitably causes significant damage to the antebrachiocarpal joint. So the image on the right-hand side of the screen, that's a bit of a no-no. That wasn't me that did that, I promise you. The fracture on the left-hand side with a single intramedullary pin shows what tends to happen where you have a single pin with no additional restraint to rotational stability. And that fracture was a long time down the line, and it was a non-union fracture. One of the relatively minor problem with the use of intramedullary pins is that they often need to be cut off level with the top of the bone. With regard to the femur, the sharp proximal end of the pin can interfere with the adjacent tissues, including the sciatic nerve. The trouble is that the soft tissues get in the way, which prevents the pin being cut short enough. It is possible to partially withdraw the pin and then cut it and then drive the pin back down into the femur, but you do need to make sure that you don't punch the distal point of the pin into the stifle joint when you do so. By far the best way of cutting intramedullary pins is with a big pair of bolt cutters. Surgical ones are available that will go through the autoclave, but you can use hardware store versions if you can sterilize them. Hacksaw blades and hacksaws will cut the stainless steel eventually, but the trouble is that stainless steel tends to work harden. So as you get through the pin, it gets harder and harder and harder, and it's pretty time consuming and unpleasant, and you do tend to cause a degree of damage to the surrounding tissues, so they are quite hard to cut off. Okay, so we know that if we use an intramedullary pin, that we'll also need to deal with axial loading and rotational forces by using other implants. These implants could very simply include the use of cerclage wires, interfragmentary Kirschner wires, and external fixation, depending on the fracture configuration. As you can see on the left radiograph, bone plates and screws can also be used, but this represents a significant step up and is beyond the scope of this talk. As a footnote, the intermedullary pin design is fundamentally quite a good idea. It has been modified to effectively deal with axial loading and rotation, by adding interlocking implants, as you can see on the right. Interlocking nails such as this generally use either screws or bolts that are drilled through holes in the bone, through holes in the nail, and then through the transcortex of the bone again. So these are widely used in human fracture repair, but they're not as widespread in veterinary patients compared to bone plates. There have been some interlocking nail systems around for many, many years. The early ones were a little bit sort of iffy. They didn't give brilliant stability, but there is now quite a good system out there. So perhaps in the future we'll see more interlocking nails being used. So if we stay with pins but move down in size, we get to the K wires that are often called arthrodesis wires. There is a difference between Kirshner wires and arthrodesis wires. And in general, if you order a K wire, you'll get a pin that has a trocar point on one end and a spade point on the other. Arthrodesis wires have two trocar points, and they're generally more useful and easier to use. Essentially, the trocar points drill into the bone an awful lot easier and produce less heat. Rush pins are another thin type of pin that are inserted through small drilled holes, and they pass into the medullary canal. They rely on spring tension within the implant, and in my experience, they're pretty hard to use compared to cross K wires. So you may see them in a textbook, but for most fractures you can that are applicable to these sorts of techniques, you can treat them with crossed K wires. K wires are a very versatile implant, and as you can see from the picture above, can be used with other implants such as sort of orthopedic wire to compress fractured surfaces together. Common uses for K wires include the stabilization of small bone fragments, especially avulsion fractures, cross pinning of physeal fractures, or as anti-rotation implants in combination with other devices. One problem that's frequently encountered when using K wires is the tendency to bend on insertion. This is best controlled by limiting the amount of exposed pin sticking out of the chuck. This is where having a dedicated pin driver is incredibly useful, as it allows the wires to be driven in multiple short lengths, which generally prevents bending. So we'll just start the video. So this first video shows drilling a very, very thin, this is a 0.8 millimeter K wire with a wire driver. So we'll just see how easy that is. So we just do tiny little short drills, and because the exposed length of wire is so short, it tends not to bend. Okay. The same thing can be done with a power drill or even a Jacob's chuck, but it does take forever, as you constantly have to drive a few millimeters of pin, loosen the chuck, back up the pin, tighten the chuck, and repeat. It's also easy to bend the pin inadvertently when tightening or loosening the chuck. If we move to the second video, this shows what happens if we try and drive a long length of pin using a standard drill. So as you can see, everything has gone totally wrong. The wire is unusable. It hasn't even penetrated even partway into the plastic sawbone, and that isn't even a big solid bone that you may be trying to repair. So because wire driving is such a pain in the backside, you know, there is a great tendency to keep a longer than necessary working length outside the chuck, and you know, as you can see from the second video, it often ends badly. It can be quite frustrating. So here we have some examples of K wire repairs. On the left, we have a distal femoral physeal separation in a cat. Normally these, I would treat these using cross pinning. The greatest difficulty with these fractures is reducing the small and fairly fragile epiphyseal fragment. And this can often be achieved by using the tibia as a lever whilst extending the stifle joint. Treating these injuries promptly often makes reduction far easier. The K wires are introduced abaxial to the trochlear ridges, so just on the outside of the trochlear ridges, and they're driven proximally and slightly caudally to engage the metaphyseal bone. After the wires are driven, the pin ends are bent over and cut off. Because the bone's often so soft, it can be hard to tell when the pin has penetrated the back of the femur, and sometimes this means that an excessively long pin is placed, which in some circumstances may need revision. Okay, that's just something you would see on your post-operative radiographs. So the second set of images on the right show a tibial tuberosity avulsion fracture and a bimalleolar, a dog with bimalleolar fractures that have been stabilized using K-wires in combination with tension band wires. In these cases, the small avulse bone fragments were under tension from the quadriceps and the medial and lateral collateral ligaments, respectively. If I just used K-wires, I would expect the repairs to have failed as the tractional forces would not have been neutralized. So bear in mind, K-wires are a relatively weak method of fixation. So before we look at how to place wires, let's consider the wire itself. Orthopedic wire is made of stainless steel and it's generally bought on rolls like this. Wires available in a variety of gauges and often probably between 16 gauge and 22 gauge are most commonly used for fractures. Occasionally some places sell pre-cut lengths of wire that may have a loop at one end, an eye at one end, and they're really for use if you have a fancy wire tensioning device. So, you know, most of the time we will use a twist to tighten the wire. So the big advantage of wire is that it's strong in tension, and we can use wire in two ways, and those are that we can either wrap the wire around some or part of the bone, okay, that's called a cyclage or a hemicyclage, and that essentially is creating a situation where the wire is acting like a metal band in a barrel and stopping the radially directed forces from propagating the fracture. Or we can resist the pull of a muscle or a tendinous structure by applying the wire as a tension band. So at the top, you can see a cyclage wire that passes around the bone entirely. It's important to be cautious when passing wires, as it's easy to strip large amounts of soft tissue off the bone fragments, and this loss of soft tissue attachment can inhibit healing. Very occasionally, I may use a hemicyclage wire, as you can see in the top right, where the wires pass through a bone tunnel and then around half of the bone. The commonest way of tightening wires is to twist the ends together, as you can see in the diagram bottom left. It's important to make sure that both ends of the wires are wrapping around each other rather than one end wrapping around the other strand, as you can see next to the red cross. This is best achieved by keeping tension on the wires whilst the ends are being twisted, as you can see in the bottom left. Okay, failure to twist the wires accurately does mean the wire will loosen prematurely, and that could be a significant problem. Once the wire is twisted, the ends are cut short, leaving a minimum of three twists. It is important not to bend the twist over after you've cut it, because that loosens the cyclage significantly. So don't forget, a loose cyclage wire is pointless. Okay, they have to be really, really tight. So the second method of using wires is as a tension band wire. If we consider the first diagram above, where a bone that's being eccentrically loaded by the surrounding muscles, the bone has one surface in tension. Let me just find the pointer again. So this surface is in tension. Let's move that out of the way. And this surface is in compression. By placing a wire on the tension surface of the bone, this allows the distractive force that tends to open the fracture up, it converts it to a compressive force which squeezes the fracture together. Okay, and that degree of compression is a very useful effect to harness. So, as you can see on the right-hand diagram, tension band wires are often anchored around K-wires at one end and pass through a bone tunnel at the other end. And the wire is twisted and cut. And where you placing a tension band wire, it is okay to bend the twisted section over, because tension bands are a little bit more tolerant of slight loosening. So tension band wires are most commonly employed where avulsion injuries have occurred. And going back to this radiograph, this is the bimalleolar fracture of a dog's distal tibia and fibula. So the malleoli are the origins of the medial and lateral collateral ligaments. So weight bearing applies significant traction on these small fracture pieces. The tension band wire resists this distractive force and converts it into a compressive force. So other situations where tension band wires are often useful include fractures of the tibial tuberosity, which are very common, fractures of the olecranon on the ulna, which fortunately are less common, the calcaneus and the patella. So we've considered the strengths and weaknesses of our main implants in turn, and we know that we're going to need to combine different implant systems. So two common combinations that we may use include the intramedullary pin and cerclage wires, and the intramedullary pin and external fixators. Where we have a long oblique fracture configuration, we can use an intramedullary pin to resist the bending, but that unfortunately does not adequately resist the rotation or the axial loading. We can use cerclage wires to help maintain reduction and also provide compression at the fracture, which helps to neutralize that rotation and shearing of the bone surfaces that occur when the bone is loaded. The rule is that if the fracture line, so the length of the fractured segment itself, is twice the width of the bone, twice the length of the bone width, then cerclage wires can be useful. Okay, we absolutely have to use them in multiples. Okay, we never use them alone, because a single cerclage wire is just a pivot. Okay, and it will lead to loosening, it will lead to breakage of the wire and loss of fracture fixation. So we have to use them in multiples, and the greater the number you can put on within reason, the better. The other fundamental to using cerclage wires is that the wires need to be really, really tight. And in order to do that, they have to be orientated perpendicular to the bone. If you place a loose cerclage, it will strip off tissue attachment and inhibit bone healing. So we need to make sure the wire is really tight. As a sort of final check, when the wire is placed, you should be able to push hard against the wire without it moving at all against the bone. So if it does move at all, it's not tight enough and you need to think about replacing it. If we consider the radiographs above, the IM pin has been well placed and is a reasonably appropriate size. I don't think it's penetrated the talocrural joint, although it is certainly very close. Multiple cerclages have been used, which is great. And they're all orientated at 90 degrees to the long axis of the bone. So all in all, that's a pretty good repair. Here we have an attempted repair that's a bit less ideal in a very young puppy. We can see that the intramedullary pin has been driven distally and has penetrated the stifle joint. Okay, this is quite easy to do in very young bone. So, you know, if you've placed a lot of IM pins, this will have happened at some stage. It certainly has happened to me in the past. The pin appears to be an appropriate size for the medullary canal diameter, but the fracture hasn't been well reduced, and there is a gap. Can't get my pointer to point in just the right orientation, but just in there we can see that the reduction is suboptimal, and that will limit the bone's ability to resist loading. Okay, the cerclage wires are also not perpendicular, to the long axis of the bone, so these wires will loosen readily. Okay. The pin has been cut off really quite long, and so the sharp edge of the pin, it will move in an arc when the femur moves, and that will highly likely cause damage to the soft tissues, possibly even the sciatic nerve. So all in all, not a great example to follow, unfortunately. With the previous examples, we looked at the use of an intramedullary pin and cerclage wires for the treatment of oblique fractures. If the fracture is transverse or a short oblique, then we cannot use cerclage wires, as we said. With a transverse fracture, the intramedullary pin will again be useful in dealing with the bending forces, and the fracture configuration itself will be capable of load bearing because the transverse fracture ends will butt up against each other. Rotation can be addressed in this situation using a simple external fixator, and this is most commonly performed for femoral fractures, but it could be applied in other places as well. After intramedullary pin placement and fracture reduction, two external fixator pins are placed before the IM pin is cut short. The first external fixator pin is placed proximally in the trochanteric region, and the second distally in the femoral condyle. These pin locations are chosen because the bone flares out proximally and distally, which means that the X-fix pins can be directed away from the intramedullary pin, which would be difficult if you were to try and place pins in the narrower mid-diaphyseal section. In general, I tend to place pins laterally in the femur and angle the X-fix pin caudal to the expected path of the intramedullary pin. Once the pins have been placed, rotational alignment is checked and a curved connecting bar, and you can use an appropriate diameter Steinmann pin is attached between the two pins and joined up to the intramedullary pin dorsal to the trochanter. Okay, so let me just get the pointer. So here we go. So up here, the intramedullary pin is left long, so it's sticking out of the skin at the top, and the connecting bar, which is over here, is straight whilst it runs parallel to the femur, and then at the top it curves over and we join the connecting bar to the intramedullary pin at the top. Okay, and that creates what's called a tied-in configuration. Doing that significantly increases the stability of the repair. When it comes to placing the connecting bar, we need to make sure that there is sufficient gap between the skin and the clamps generally, so in these areas. So normally I would try to leave 1 to 2 centimeters between the skin surface and the nearest part of the external fixator frame. Now, going back to the minimal equipment theme, if you don't have external fixator clamps in your practice, then we can use some epoxy putty. Okay, now epoxy putty comes in this sausage with a grey outer and a black inner, and you basically cut off a length of it and unwrap it and then knead the dough together, and it starts out like a stiff plasticine type of consistency, but within about 10 minutes it goes hot, it has an exothermic reaction, and it goes absolutely rock hard. So we can use this in relatively small animals if we don't have an external fixator clamp, or because we can mold the the epoxy putty around the pins that we want to join together. Okay, and this can be a really useful thing to do if you do have minimal equipment, and or even for very complex fractures. So I'll often treat jaw fractures with an external fixator where we just fire lots of little pins in around the whole circumference of the jaw almost, and then create an epoxy putty connecting bar that runs right the way around the jaw. So they can be really useful. So epoxy putty keeps in the cupboard. You don't have to sterilize it. It's applied after the event when you're out of theatre. It keeps forever, and that can be a really useful thing to have in the cupboard. Okay. So, in conclusion, it is possible to tackle some fractures with minimal equipment, but it's really important that you execute the repair well, because weak and flexible fixation can be quite unforgiving of technical errors. So make a very careful assessment before surgery, okay? Take really nice quality radiographs. Don't be frightened to retake them if they're not quite what you want, okay? Only attempt cases with high fracture scores, so I'm meaning a 9 or a 10. If in doubt, seek advice, okay, but don't listen to old wives' tales. Cats don't heal on their own, okay. Three-legged animals don't do really well. They do adequately, and don't use a single IM pin, okay. If you consider the forces of axial loading, bending, rotation, and shear, and if you make sure you neutralize all of these forces using a combination of implants where necessary and preserving the soft tissues as you go, then you stand a really good chance of obtaining a successful outcome, even though you may only have a few pins, some wire, and some epoxy putty. Okay, it can be done, but just be careful about it. If in doubt, ring a more experienced colleague and run the plan past them. And there are always different ways of treating fractures, but if you seek advice before you get into a problem, you'll be a lot better off. So I think we're maybe a few minutes ahead of time. So if anyone has any questions, then we will be more than happy to address them. Now I see that we have a question. Can you advise on how to make better knots in cyclage wire? I've been trying for years but still get irregular results. I usually use a pair of wire holding forceps, but not the one with the hole in each jaw like your photo. Is this important when getting an equal knot, or is lifting away from the bone as you're rotating? Also, do you cut off at three loops? And that is from Simon Ratcliffe. So thank you very much for the question, Simon. Twisting cyclage wire. I don't use the holes in the jaw of the wire twisters at all. Okay, it's quite fiddly passing it through, and I'm always too impatient. But what I do is when I'm starting off, I'll pass the wire around the bone and cross it over, so there's an X, and then I'll use two pairs of wire twisters, one on each end. And I'll physically move the wires around one another so that I get one, maybe two twists to get the twist started. And that initially makes sure that the two wires are twisting around each other. Okay. once I've got that, even though it's loose at this point, I can then take the wire twisters off, take the wire twisting forceps off, and clamp one pair onto the two bits of wire, and then I pull nice and evenly and try not to pull the wire off at an angle. I always try and pull it vertically upwards, and if you twist and pull, then you should continue with the one wire twisting around the other, if that makes sense. Okay. It is something to practice. So if you get a roll of orthopedic wire, or even cannibalize a piece of electric cable and strip the copper out, you can practice it just on a piece of wood or a screwdriver handle or something like that. You can practice it with copper wire that you may be about to throw in the bin, there's a bit of a knack to it. But if you get the twist started straight away and make sure the wires are twisting around one another, then that generally helps. Okay, so hopefully that answers the question.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Simon for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate of this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.